Well, hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. All right. I think everybody heard me, Dr. Diana Wiley. Yes, and on this near eve of Valentine's Day, our topic is the science of love, because new research can teach us about romance and how to make it last. And before I introduced my wonderful friend and guest, Dr. Serena McKinsey, just a couple of background words about love. The ancient Greeks called it the madness of the gods. And somebody else, an author, dubbed it the divine accident of life. But as it turns out, love is neither madness nor an accident. And so the more we understand how the brain works, the more it seems we can really understand how we're programmed for love. Welcome to this program, Dr. Serena McKinsey.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, Serena and I have known each other over 4 years, and we've collaborated quite a lot, her patients, my clients, and because Serena McKinsey, a naturopath, the director of the Whole Life Medicine Clinic, and I'm going to have her tell you about that in a moment, is a sexual medicine expert, and she is nationally licensed as a sex counselor through the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. And when you go to wholelifemedicine.net, you'll read that she enjoys playful living. And I can attest to that because we are friends. And playful living is such a, it's a wonderful thing to have that, isn't it, Serena?
It is, and it's very very relevant to being happy in love, which is, I think, our topic today.
That's our topic today, yes. So, Serena, the Whole Life Medicine Center is balancing health for body and beyond. It's fairly new, and I'm feeling very privileged to be your sex therapist on the staff. But tell us how this came about and some of the problems and issues that the Whole Life Medicine Center addresses.
Well, the Whole Life Medicine itself has been my business for a long time, since, 2006, so maybe long, maybe short, depending on how you look at time. But my business moved very recently and merged with Washington Urology and Urogynecology, so I'm now a professional member of one of the largest urology and gynecology specialty groups, which is fantastic because we've merged together to create a medical specialty care center for sexual concerns for both men, women, and other gendered individuals. So we created this center, and we're in the process of launching an institute for healthy sexuality in this coming year, which is very exciting, alongside my primary care practice, which is the Whole Life Medicine business. So, we have launched this business because there's such a high prevalence of sexual dysfunction in our population. Many studies have shown a 44% occurrence of sexual dysfunction in both men and women of some kind. And there's a lot of different sexual dysfunction. So our facility that's established now and that will be launching additional programs with collaboration with other professionals in the Seattle area, such as yourself, came to fruition out of some really brilliant minds in different medical fields and psychological fields, and very excited about it. So,
and it's your baby.
It is. I'm very, very excited.
Yes. I mean, you have two adorable, not so much babies anymore, but a son and a daughter, and they're just such lovely children. It's a testament to how well you and your husband parent.
Oh, well, that's kind of you. Thank you.
Well, it's true. And it's been a privilege for me to know you and to know you professionally and to also to know you personally. And I've learned so much from you. And so today I'm hoping our listeners will learn from both of us. We're coming up, as I said at the top of the show, on Valentine's Day, which is Friday. And so I thought we would talk about the power of chemistry, because to begin with, because love is a chemical reaction. It's researchers, and especially Helen Fisher, they look at brain activity and of people newly in love, and they can see the interplay of hormones and neurotransmitters, and the four compounds mainly, and I'm hoping we can talk about each of them, dopamine, norepinephrine, oxytocin, and serotonin. And these are particularly critical. Helen Fisher has shown. Weren't you fascinated with Helen Fisher's research when it first came out, and doesn't it continue to be just really quite original and fascinating?
I think it's very fascinating. I mean, whenever we're looking at, you know, research for both attraction and lust and sustainability of erotic emotions towards a partner, it's all fascinating. And, you know, there's been a lot of MRI studies looking at both, you know, the love biochemistry, but also looking at sexual response in both men and women and what the commonalities are and the differences between men and women. It's just all fascinating to me. And, you know, I think that she has definitely done some groundbreaking work, and we continue to have more and more information come out over the decades. But what also fascinates me endlessly is how much we still don't know, and
yes,
how much we don't know about pheromones, for example, or some of the biochemistry, or the regulation of our gene expression, for example. There's a, you know, an entire new field of like epigenetics developing that I think, as we consider how that influences our attraction and our mate finding capacities, it's all very fascinating. And you know, so I think she was really at the beginning of a really continuously built upon areas of study that is fascinating, but ever fascinating.
So this dopamine, the neurotransmitter, as I understand it, it makes you focus on the beloved and desire more time with him or her. And it is perhaps central to the brain's reward circuitry. So you do something highly pleasurable and dopamine is released. And it effectively tells the brain, do it one more time. Don't you think?
Yes, I think that, you know, there we also activate neurotransmitters such as dopamine by, you know, substance use, for example. I mean, you know, cocaine or nicotine, or I think there's all these different ways to stimulate the reward center and the pleasure centers in our brain, and some are productive and some can be unproductive. And I think when we're looking at trying to initiate a positive romantic and lustful connection in relationships, having healthy stimulus of those neurotransmitter releases is ideal and interesting.
Healthy, yes, because as I understand it, liquor both lowers inhibitions and may increase dopamine, but of course too much is not so good, but it's probably why half the world's relationships seem to start over a glass of wine.
Yes, and I think, you know, epinephrine, norepinephrine, serotonin, these are other hormones that are all very complex, and prolactin and oxytocin, and there is no straightforward equation that we understand medically that we can say, this is how it happens for every single person. It's usually a really complex inner network of how these neurotransmitters are interacting with each other. And we know, for example, serotonin, for example, is something where we have a lot of medications that cause sexual side effects, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors,
which
are commonly used for depression and anxiety. And sexual side effects are so high in these medications because they're interfering and they're blocking some of the production of serotonin. And so, you know, there's so many things in our environment, in both how we behave and what medications we take and what kind of stimulus we engage in or don't engage in, that have interactions with how our biochemistry is expressed. And that has such a complex relationship with how we bond with people and how we are sexually stimulated or lack of sexual stimulation. It's very fascinating. And, you know, I think that the pharmaceutical industry is very eagerly interested to find a consistency in this neurotransmitter or pheromone equation, because they, of course, would love to have a medication that can mimic these hormones of love and attachment. And I think to some degree that'll always be a pursuit in futility, because I don't believe that a medication alone can stimulate those complex emotions that we have when we're in love or in lust. And but there'll continue to be efforts, and
right.
I think hormones and medications, all these things play a role, and we'll just continue to learn more over time.
Mm-hmm. So I have seen, and I know you have as well, there's so many people on the SSRIs who do have the sexual side effects, and their desire goes down. But what's interesting about serotonin and the obsessing part of love is that, and this was a study done in Italy, it found that men in love had less testosterone than their single brethren, but women in love, on the other hand, had more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they had more testosterone, so they were maybe given more permission in their own minds anyway, or they just did it to be a little wilder and more free.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's also was a study last year that I thought was really fascinating, showing that men who were highly involved in parenting and strongly attached to their children had lower testosterone levels than comparable men of the same age. So I think, you know, what that suggests to me is that there may perhaps be some sort of biochemistry associated with bonding for men that is a different biochemistry than what is associated for women. But, I mean, at the same time, there's so many biochemical differences. There's also so many overlaps and similarities. It's hard to say it's any one given thing. And I think we'll just continue to see these interconnected pieces.
So the urge to merge, oxytocin, the hormone of attachment and emotional empathy. I know from some of the patients that we share that you have been interested in the nasal oxytocin.
Intranasal. Oxytocin is a interesting area. There's really very, from the medical side of it, there is very minimal literature so far published on intranasal oxytocin. But what is there is, I think, intriguing, and it is a therapy I've been utilizing in certain patients for some time now. And, you know, I think that the idea behind it is that it helps improve that capacity of bonding. And, for example, for a woman who's lactating or nursing, her oxytocin levels tend to be elevated. There's a series of oxytocin characteristics that we see in a woman who's laboring and birth and delivery. And, you know, so I think the idea behind it is that it's considered a bonding hormone, and that by providing oxytocin through this intranasal spray, it has a very short half-life. So I always joke with patients, it's something that needs to be administered about 15 minutes before sexual activity, and it's an intranasal spray that needs to be kept in the refrigerator. So how sexy is that? I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, excuse me, honey, let me go to the kitchen and spray something up my nose, and I'll be right back. But at any rate, you know, I think that there's also some potential developing applications in autism and spectrum disorder treatment of helping improve that capacity to bond and be attached to another person. So, you know, I mean, I think this is all such an interesting area of discussion because, let's say, theoretically, even if we could alter how someone bonds or who you're attracted to, would we really want to do that? And I don't have an answer to that, but there's definitely adversarial opinions about some of these tinkering around biochemistry to influence sexual function and emotional bonding. And I think it's a really healthy debate and to look at both sides of that. But if we could enhance bonding to someone that maybe biologically we don't want to be bonded to, is that going to be a good thing or not? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. As I understand it, the intranasal oxytocin, when it's administered many times, the people will look more deeply into the eyes of the person they're with, and they'll report feeling a greater sense of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think you probably have read about the research using prairie voles, and these are the voles that mate for life unless their oxytocin receptors are blocked. And then they don't become bonded to another partner. You can introduce two voles whose receptors are blocked, and they can mate all night long, and the next day they just don't care.
Right.
And so they can do the research with the voles, and then their cousins, the other voles, what are they? Prairie voles, and then I guess the mountain voles, they're the ones who are promiscuous, but prairie voles are usually monogamous until their receptors are blocked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that there, you know, these are, again, there's so many interactions that influence all of these different neurochemical states in our body. And I think how we respond ourselves and how someone else responds to us and our environment and the influences in terms of, you know, medications or drugs or even herbs or supplements that we're taking all influence these fluctuating hormonal connections. And it's a big mesh in there trying to figure it all out.
And then just from a purely emotional, psychological point of view, I've heard women say that in terms of love, kindness and showing appreciation means everything. It's true. For a man who will treat her kindly, the best woman will give and forgive much. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I often say to guys, treat her kindly. That's all. That's everything. You know, call her, return her call, show up on time, give her shelter as well as freedom, all of these things.
Absolutely. Gratitude, I think, is a foundation for a lot of really healthy relationships and appreciation and being attentive to mm-hmm. each other's needs. You know, I think that is a fundamental that sometimes gets lost in the shuffle of our very busy lives.
Yes, and that's why I sometimes end my sessions with a couple where I ask them to for a minute or two each to offer the other sweet nothings. And these are simply declarations of what they appreciate and love about the other. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I've had a man break down and cry during because he wasn't used to hearing what his wife appreciated about him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes. So let's go on, Serena, to talking about, because the program is really about the science of love. So sense, the smell, and sensibility. So chemistry and pheromones. And there's still a lot, you indicated this earlier in our discussion, there's still a lot we don't know about pheromones. These are the chemical messengers that are said to be exuded by the body to influence behavior and moods of others. What do you think about pheromones?
I think pheromones are very real. I think that, well, mm-hmm. if anyone were decided to put research money into it in any large quantity, I think they'd find a lot of really interesting topics.
Yeah.
I think the complication is that in order to put a lot of research money behind something, there needs to be a product that's going to come out of it that's going to reimburse for the research. So I think, you know, pheromones are going to be a difficult thing to make money out of, therefore there may be limited research over time on it. But I think that there is something very strong about chemistry between two people, and I think that our sense of smell and other senses and how we're attracted to individuals is huge. I mean, I had a patient a few years back who came to see me for low libido, and one of the comments I remember her making was that I can't stand the way that my husband smells.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking in my mind, I'm like, right there, I just knew that was going to be a pretty, you know, that was a significant statement to me. And, you know, we worked together for a year or two or so, and she did eventually end up separating from her husband. And there were a lot of other things going on, too, of course. It's never,
right.
I don't like the way someone smells, let's get a divorce. But one of the very subtle indicators of the health of a relationship in terms of how we interact in that pheromone plane with a partner. And you may think it's different and more important for certain people than it is for others. Everyone has different priorities and different needs that they really would like to have met in a relationship. And I do think that some people are more pheromone-oriented than maybe someone else. There's some people who need more emotions or need more this or...
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a lot of variance in how people experience pheromones, but I do believe that it's an underlying, really important trait of love and love.
Well, our sense of smell is from a very primitive part of our brain, as I understand it. So that's why we can smell something and it maybe evokes a memory from a long time ago.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, a lot of our bonding as children when we're attaching to, mm-hmm. to parents and attaching to loved ones has a lot to do with pheromones and
mm-hmm.
smells. And because those senses are far more reliant as we're developing when we're younger than as we're older. So I think that we have a lot of things that we're just not even aware of in terms of how we relate to pheromones. And I think that there are some products that have been developed already that try to mimic pheromones or manipulate the pheromone chemistry between individuals. And I'd be curious to see how those products continue to develop and if there's any relevance to them. I'm not sure at this point that we know for sure.
So the pheromone thing, some studies have shown that during ovulation, women are more attentive to sexual messages from the outside world. So they might dress more provocatively and stare at more handsome men. So I think, Serena, this begs the question, does a woman's estrous cycle have a discernible effect on male behavior?
Well, you know, I think that's a really interesting topic, too. I read a study not that long ago, I can't remember where I read it, that individuals who are in the sex entertainment industry, who are performers, sexuality-related, whether they're strippers or dancers or erotic dancers or whatnot, that the dancers who are ovulating consistently were found to have higher wages for any given night than women who are not ovulating, with all other factors kept the same. And I remember reading that and thinking, wow, that's so interesting that, you know, you get the same group of five women and you can track, you know, their wages or their interest from male patrons throughout any given night of a month, and that the women who were ovulating, regardless of anything else, were the ones who were most attractive to
them. Well, so she does a lap dance and she gets a bigger tip if she happens to be ovulating.
Well, that's what this research was suggesting.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was a very large study, but it does beg the interesting question. And there are several studies that have suggested similar findings, that women have a different presence, they have a different attraction to potential partners, and they also are attractive to potential partners in a different way during that ovulation. And I don't think medically that we are very attentive to that, but I do know that there's a lot of suggestion that that's relevant. So, you know, if a woman is utilizing some form of birth control that suppresses her ovulation, such as a contraceptive pill or multiple other means of birth control, how does that influence that sexual chemistry? I don't know the answer to that. I know that we do have sexual side effects with some forms of birth control, and that's primarily related to how it interferes with some of our sex hormone binding globulins and our transport molecules for hormones, and how we are available, have hormones free in the body to relate to sexual function. So there is known consequences of birth control methods that influence ovulation, but I'm not familiar of medical literature that is related to ovarian suppression in and of itself in terms of partner attraction or whatnot, but very likely.
Well, there was a study, University of Sheffield in England, where women on the pill no longer experience a greater desire during ovulation for traditionally masculine men, and the study speculated that men no longer exhibited a higher or lower degree of interest for the woman on the pill based on her menstrual cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I remembered, it must be 10 years ago at least, I did hear Helen Fisher lecture at one of my conferences, and she said that women on the pill do not fall in love in the same ways.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, if you consider the amount of individuals in our population that are either on an oral contraceptive pill or a medication for a mood disorder, such as depression or anxiety, these are highly prevalent medication prescribing. And, you know, it just always makes me kind of step back and wonder. Not that these are all very appropriate and medically warranted therapies, of course. There's absolutely nothing inherently problematic with a birth control pill or with an antidepressant that is clearly needed. But it does make you step back and wonder what our culture look like without those types of interruptions into some of these pheromone and hormonal cycles. And I don't know, but it just kind of is an interesting question because, I mean, I don't know what the statistics of how many women and men are on some combination of, you know, medications that have these side effects, but it's enormously high.
What would
look like if, you know, a woman who is on an antidepressant and a man who is on an antidepressant, like, are there studies that look at what their pheromone interactions are if they're both in a altered biochemical state, right? I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're better matched for each other that way.
they're better matched, perhaps, and they both probably don't have a very high libido.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, I talk with people about low libido and high libido all day long, and I think that there are some correlations, but I think there are plenty of women who have a completely healthy sex drive on in these medications. So there is no given. And I think for birth control pills in particular, there are millions of women who are completely happy and fine with their libido. And
well, so many years ago when I was on the birth control pill, I don't think it ever affected my libido. So, yeah, there's lots of variation.
Yes.
And so what about depression when somebody's on a birth control pill and or on an SSRI for depression?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the interaction? Can you break that down a little more, Dr. Serena?
Well,
the interaction with sex drive.
Well, and I think, you know, when we're looking at depression and medication treatment for depression, we're in between a little bit of a rock and a hard place, because an individual who has clinical depression commonly is not interested in sex in that place. And so, you know, when we're looking at that from the clinical management aspect of it, it's like, yes, we know that there's a high prevalence of sexual side effects from many antidepressant and anti-anxiety medications. However, we also know that not treating that individual appropriately commonly has sexual consequences as well. So, you know, it's a difficult line to walk. And for some individuals, there are non-medication treatments that are very effective. Talk therapy, psychotherapy, of course. Uh-huh. The amount of research we have on exercising, improving mood would be like a bazillion-dollar drug if we had the same research of how effective treating mood as exercise.
Yeah, exercise, because it increases the stores of dopamine in the brain, I think, a lot of times, and so it may drive up optimism and renewed hope.
Yes, absolutely, and you know, there's several studies actually that do show exercise improves sexual function as well.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So, you know, I think when I'm talking to somebody who's concerned about either depression or sexual side effects of a mood medication, then we're always having the conversation of like, what can we optimize in other areas of life so that we're feeling vital and alive and healthy?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that allows us to reduce the need for a medication, but some people just need to be on medications and their mental health is far improved when they have a medication. So there are medical strategies to reduce the sexual side effects. There are different medications of different categories that have lowered occurrence for some people versus others. There's a lot of juggling that can be done on the medical side of things if we get to the point where medication is absolutely necessary. And commonly it is. I mean, there are many very appropriate uses of antidepressant medications. So that's always an individualized kind of evaluation on that front.
So before we need to go to our break, our half past the hour break, I wanted to just finish up with what I'm calling sense and sensibility, that scent may even play a role in kissing. And from what I understand, scientists aren't exactly sure why people kiss. Well, I know it's lots of fun and very pleasurable, but some postulate that it's a reminder of the intimacy of early feeding experiences.
Hmm.
And others believe it's a way of getting close enough to experience a potential partner's smell.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking even health,
mm-hmm.
the health of the mouth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The teeth. I wonder what they did in the Middle Ages when we didn't have dentistry. Must have been really.
I don't have
stinky.
An answer to that, but that's a good inquiry. I don't know. You know, I mean, from the medical side, I have to say there's just not that much to say about kissing on the medical side. But I think in the psychological and the, you know, psychosocial aspects of it and bonding and just being intimate. I mean, you know, there are individuals in my practice who are sex workers who, for example,
yeah.
would prefer not to engage in kissing if they're providing sex acts in return for money. And I think that, to me, has always said something, that there's something different about kissing and that it is a distinct act from some other forms of sexual activity that we can have with someone. And I think there's a vulnerability related to kissing.
Yeah.
I think that there is definitely One could argue that there's a compatibility criteria somewhere in there in the kissing front, if that you absolutely, similar to what we're talking about with pheromones. It's like if there's someone whose smell you absolutely can't tolerate, or if you just can't stand the way someone kisses, that could have suggestions for where incompatibilities might run in other areas sexually, and maybe not. I mean, of course, there's no definitives, but I do find that couples will say to me, at any rate, and I imagine they may say this to you as well, is that, well, you know, maybe X, Y, and Z is good in the relationship, but boy, I just don't like the way he kisses me. And that becomes like a focus of problem.
That's right.
It seems
right.
bigger than you would think.
And I hear that, and I sometimes will suggest that the woman might say to the man, I'm going to kiss you the way I'd like you to kiss me.
Mm-hmm.
So please pay attention.
Well, and I do think that there's a lot of aspects about sex that we can learn, many aspects of sex that we can learn. I think there's also some aspects of sex that we have an inherent compatibility or incompatibility with other people about. And I've seen that over and over and over in the years of, like, sometimes you meet someone and you're just fantastic at playing the piano with them. And other people, you could practice for years and you still can't play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star together very well. And, you know, I think that there's just, to me, the kissing factor has some aspect to do with compatibility in other areas. And, you know, whether
I agree.
Pheromone thing, is it a technique thing? I don't know. I don't know what it is.
There are so many mysteries, and that's part of the reason both of us are involved with sexuality. It's fascinating. It's complex. And on that note, we're going to go to our half past the hour break. So stay with us, and when we come back, Dr. Serena and I are going to talk about love that lasts, and because we got to talk about that as we approach Valentine's Day. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Cosa leggerai? Con che libro affascini il tuo cuore? E se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amaro autore, ma i tuoi piedi.
We're back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, here with Dr. Serena McKenzie, who is a naturopath doctor, brilliant, wonderful, my friend, my colleague. So glad that Serena's back on this program. And so we want to finish up in the last half hour talking about love that lasts. And some wise man said, love at first sight is easy to understand. It's when two people have been looking at each other for a lifetime that it becomes a miracle. So, yes, there is some truth to that. And monogamy, while it's often said is natural, it's not always easy. And there may be some biological reasons, because as I understand it, and I really want your reaction to this, Dr. Serena, both sexes have inherited the brain circuitry for deep attachment to a mate. But some scientists believe that men are predisposed to procreate and to do that with as many females as possible, and women are designed to land the best providers by any means necessary. We're hardwired to do this, and Christopher Ryan talks about that in his book Sex at Dawn. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, Sex at Dawn is a very interesting book, and it talks about the, you know, as you were just discussing, the evolution of relationship structure, and that in terms of historical evolution and sociology perspectives, monogamy is very new in our in our evolution, and that it really developed from the need to have ownership over property and to have ownership over offspring, and that prior to having land or buildings or farming institutions that needed to have ownership to them, that monogamy was not part of our human evolution for a very long time, for hundreds of years, and that there was a much more of a village, raised by the village mentality. So what I think is interesting about the Sex at Dawn book was that he didn't necessarily write this book to advocate for we should all be running around in a village and, you know, all having as many partners or children as wives as we want. He was just like, yeah. Well, this is just what I found. I don't really know what to do with it.
And
he says that straight in the book. He's like, I don't know, but this is, you know, scientifically what has been found to be true. And I think that is interesting. I think the doctrine around some religious teachings also have had a strong institution around monogamy, and there's some true benefits to monogamy, and that's a relationship structure that works very well for some individuals. But if we look at our culture modern day and we look at statistically how few couples actually remain in monogamous lifelong relationship, and we look at the statistical prevalence of adultery, the statistical prevalence of multiple marriages in a lifetime, we really are not that monogamous of a culture, even though we tend to identify that way. We tend to say monogamous, when really more accurate, I think, is a serial monogamous culture.
Uh-huh, yes.
In that many people have recurrent relationships within a monogamous structure. And to me, it's like whatever works. I mean, when I'm talking with patients and we have these conversations about, which I have on a much less detailed form than you do in sex therapy, but it's like, well, what works for you? What's really the value and the meaning and the purpose of the relationship structure? Because you and I both work with individuals who have non-monogamy relationship structures and who are either involved in swinging or polyamory, which is conscientious non-monogamy, so like multiple love relationships. And I don't think that those alternative relationship structures are always going to work out for every person, but we also know monogamy doesn't work out for every single person. So
now, according to the CDC, the married are less likely to smoke or drink heavily than people who are single, divorced, or widowed. And then other studies show that they also have reduced levels of sexually transmitted diseases, which makes sense, and lower rates of suicide. So married people want to live longer and be happier, if not chubbier, because it's shown that married men tend to be heavier than single men, and I suppose women too. The study I read, it just talked about the men. So
yeah, and I think overall, a lot of these studies, you know, such as the Normal Bar, which is a book that, you know, our friend and colleague Schwartz recently published, and there's been several studies that have shown, also looking at surveys as well as studies that have shown that people who are married typically have a higher quality of mental health life and that they are, generally speaking, happier when they have a successful monogamous relationship, I think.
Exactly.
I think if you're in a relationship that's unsatisfying and emotionally painful, then certainly your quality of happiness is not going to be higher than a single comparative person. But you know, there's health benefits to partnership. There is emotional benefits to partnership. And I think we have scientifically documented a lot of these benefits.
Yeah. And so there was an article that was published in the New York Times a few days ago by Lori Gottlieb, Does a More Equal Marriage Mean Less Sex? And I sent you the link for it. And our friend Pepper Schwartz was quoted a number of times in it. But the thing that I want to mention right now is because sometimes women wanting to spice up their long-term relationship wants their man to dominate them. And so Lori Gottlieb quotes a woman in her late 30s. She's been in a peer marriage, so that meant egalitarian. The husband helped out with chores and across the board, and they were really good they were good teammates. And so, but she wanted her husband to be more forceful, rougher in bed. And Lori Gottlieb writes, the result was comical. He was trying to do what I wanted, she explained, but he was so careful. I didn't want him to ask, are you okay? I want him not to care if I'm okay, to just, you know, not be a good husband and take charge. And And Pepper, in another part of the article, points out that women who have more power outside of the bedroom these days want to abandon that power and be more submissive for, say, an hour and not have to be responsible.
Yeah, I think that there's so much that has changed in our culture in the past 20 years around gender roles and parenting. And, you know, as that article notes, the percentage of couples that both work outside the home, even after childbearing, is over 60% now. And so we have such a different dynamic around who is the, quote, breadwinner, who is the, quote, who wears the pants in the marriage kind of situation. And I think this is making some real changes in how we view romance and how we view sexual satisfaction. And to me, it could be a woman who wants more dominance in bed. It could equal be a man who wants a woman to be more dominant in bed. You know, I mean,
yes,
to
I've heard that for sure.
Yeah, we hear it. To me, the conversation is more that I at least have with people is, what's authentic for you? What's the that true expression that you're looking for, or that true sense of what's erotic in your mind and in your world, and what is that true for the partner? And I think it, as Pepper mentions in the article, I do think that it is true that a lot of women who have entered the workforce and become capable and competent in their career and have such an enormous amount of responsibility, both at home raising children and in the workforce, there is that desire, that need to relinquish control and to have dominance over them in other areas sexually. But I think that can be true for men too. So, you know, I think communicating that need, and we've spent so much time in recent relationship evolution of, like, no, we need to be equal. And, you know, women's movement and postmodern feminism and all these things are saying, you know, women are equal and we have that opportunity. And yet, ironically, like this article that you're referencing states, and what I know you and I both see in our clinical practice, is that a lot of women will say, my husband is awesome. You know, he takes out the garbage. He's very proactive. He's engaged in the parenting.
Yes.
And I have no interest to have raging sex with him ever.
Right.
You know, and
it's a paradox, isn't it?
It is a paradox, and it's a frustrating paradox because a lot of women feel like, yay, I've won, you know, an equal contribution to society and to marriage, and wow, it's really taken out certain edges in the relationship where, you know, now I look at my husband covered in baby food just like I'm covered in baby food, and it's not hot anymore to me, you know, and he changes diapers, and that's great. And a lot of women are really confused by this because they're like, I love my partner deeply, and he's my best friend, and I feel so comfortable with him, and I'm so happy with him, and we run the house well, and we pay the mortgage together, and yet sexually and erotically it's devoid. And I think this is a challenge of modern day sex therapy, in my personal opinion, because what is the solution to that, and how do we, you know, help people find that balance that they're looking for in their outside life, but help encourage that disruption in the intimate world that a lot of people are craving. They're craving to have adventure and stimulus and something that's risk-taking.
So the article also quoted Dan Savage, our local guy who's a nationally syndicated sex columnist, and at a recent talk, one woman asked him if a certain sex act was loving or degrading. And he said, yes, why can't it be both?
Right.
And he said, people have to learn to compartmentalize. We all want to be objectified by the person we love at times. We all want to be with somebody who can flip the switch and see you as an object for an hour. So sometimes sex is indeed an expression of anger or a struggle for power and dominance. They may work in concert, and people need to learn how to harness those impulses. And here's the word that's so important, playfully, in ways that are both acceptable in equal relationships.
There's an interesting quote that you just read from him, because I don't think every person wants to be degraded.
I agree with you.
Some people find that erotic, but some people find, people find anything erotic. Some people find bubble tape, erotic. I mean, it can be absolutely anything. So what I take away from that quote is not that go out and, ask your husband to degrade you and that'll make your sex life better. What it says to me is, what is it that you find erotic? And then ask for that. And maybe it is being degraded. I mean, that works for some people, and that's fine if that's a consensual exchange. But I think that you can't make a generalized, everybody wants to be degraded comment. I don't think that's necessarily accurate. But
I think in general, S&M, fear may be a sauce, but too much can be a shutdown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think that exploration and compartmentalizing is a key and interesting piece, because what I do see in a lot of couples, especially who have children, it's like, I'm mommy and now I'm supposed to be the slut in the bedroom and the kids are outside, playing with their Legos and I can hear them, or they're asleep and that's still listening. That difficulty in compartmentalizing is a struggle for a lot of couples too, of like, well, I'm out cooking dinner and making macaroni and cheese, and now I'm supposed to be in the bedroom wearing high heels and fishnets, and that just feels incongruent, and that can be a really awkward adjustment. Or for individuals whose children are grown and adults and maybe move back into the house, that's another common conundrum I hear, of like,
I thought I had an empty nest. Now they've come back. This article, let's see if I can find it. It pointed out that in the porn world, MILFs were the most searched out, and that in the past it might have been, I can't find it, but I can remember it. In the past it might have been a young woman, and now it's the woman, the mother, with three children and a graduate degree, and yet she's vital and sexual, so and very interesting.
Well, and I have, it's what that makes me remember. I have a friend who is involved in the sex entertainment industry. He runs a club. And one of the things he told me that I hadn't thought of was that he has some performers, some dancers who are middle-aged women, who are not the average, very, very young woman that you think of for a sex entertainment facility. And he said that that's actually a very popular performer in his club, a woman who takes very good care of herself, who's in her 50s, and that a lot of men aren't really interested in looking at a woman who's as young as their daughter or their granddaughter. And they really enjoy having this different visual stimuli. And I hadn't really thought of that before in the context, at least, of his industry. And so I think that looking for, sexual stimulus or fantasies or things that we enjoy to look at that are genuine to our phase of life is really healthy, generally speaking. And, the MILF concept is the idea that, yes, you can eroticize what's real, I think, is what that says to me. It's like, it's real that a lot of people have children, and it's real that you're in your 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and still want to have sexual fantasies that are healthy for you. And if you're, an individual in your 60s, having a sexual fantasy about a 19-year-old young woman is maybe not appropriate for you, or just doesn't feel good. And so having...
Doesn't feel good.
Yeah, and maybe having stimulus or thoughts or things that are appealing of someone who's similar in your age feels more interesting or are a better fit. So I think finding those things in life is good. I don't think that there's...
It's good, too. And Nina Hartley's long career of 30-plus years is a testament to that.
Yes.
She's still performing. She's still having a great time. I know her a little bit personally. She's been on this program. And she's a very vital woman in her early 50s. She's beautiful. She's sexually open and free. And men really like to look at her website, Nina.com. Because she's having a good time.
Well, and I think all of this goes back to what we were started the show with, of how to find ways to stimulate that neuro and biochemistry to enjoy our sexual function in our emotional and intimate relationships. And, you know, visual stimuli, looking at, you know, different visual imagery, different conversations, dancing. I mean, all these different things that we can do are stimulating some of that dopamine and epinephrine and oxytocin and all this different, you know, soup, so to speak, of the soup of biochemistry, and that's what I think is healthy about some of these different activities that we're discussing, is finding ways to stimulate, you know, positive sexual and emotional experiences around love.
Well, absolutely, and thank you for kind of bringing it back. We still have a few minutes, but you're right, that's the soup, and thinking about the soup.
The sexy
and
soup. We can call it the sexy soup.
The sexy soup. Jeez, that could be a title for a book.
Yeah. The biochemistry of love that lasts. Sexy soup.
So there was another study done, and this one was done by researchers at Cornell Medical College in Stony Brook. And they compared the brain scans of couples who had just fallen in love with those of men and women who had been married an average of 21 years, and said, this was a small group, but anyway, they said they were still intensely in love with their spouses. So those in long-term relationships were shown images of their partners as well as close friends and sort of neutral acquaintances. And guess what? When the subjects saw their beloved's image, the dopamine-rich VTA lit up, that's part of the brain, lit up like a pinball machine. The brain scans were similar to those in the first blush of love, but there was a difference. And the difference was the activity in the areas of the brain where serotonin is produced, which means anxiety and obsessive thinking, that didn't exist. There was elevated calmness and pleasure. So they're in a secure phase of love, and they still desire one another, and they're engaged, and they experience the intensity, but not the anxiety. So, you know, that's what I wish for people, you know, just any person who's dear to us as we approach Valentine's Day, that they can have that sort of intensity of love, and it can last.
Yes, I think that's the goal. I think people just want to be happy. It's not that complicated, right? And when we're sharing our lives with someone, we would like to have continued happiness in the realm of sexual. I think sexual compatibility is really important. And again, it's less important to some people than others. There's some people who really value that, but more than others. But I think the goal definitely for most of us, I believe, is if we're going to be in partnership, we want it to be great, and we want it to be great as we go through our lives.
Indeed, we do. And, you know, I use attachment theory a fair amount in my work, and Sue Johnson wrote a book called Hold Me Tight, and she talks about secure and saucy sex. And she says that passion is like everything else. It ebbs and flows, but sex is always going to be boring if it's one-dimensional, if it's cut off from the emotional connection. So, but if you're emotionally connected, and she calls it the synchrony sex. Mm-hmm. Where there's emotional openness and responsiveness and tender touch, but still there is erotic exploration, and they all come together. And they can do that more easily because people that are securely attached and know their partners, they can express their needs and preferences and are more willing to experiment sexually with their lovers. Mm-hmm. We're back to sort of self-confidence and sexual confidence, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what you're talking about is some area that is of divergent opinions in sex therapy. And, you know, for example, Gottman Institute, which does some really great work in the area here on relationships, it has a focus of attachment theory, and that communicating and being close and being bonded is the foundation of a very stimulating sexual life, whereas we have some contrasting opinions in the field, such as David Snarch and Esther Perel, where they believe that there needs to be some degree of separation between a couple that creates a dynamic of eroticism, intention, and risk and adventure. And so I think it's both. I think that there needs to be an exploration into these different states of being in relationship with one another, and that on a given day, maybe we need to feel very close and tender with a partner. On another given day, maybe we need to explore or have the freedom to explore something that's different than what we have on another day. So I think being able to go through the spectrum of these different needs is what I consider an erotic intelligence or an emotional intelligence. And there's similarities in different camps of thought around that. There's also differences, and it's all relevant in my perspective.
I think that your future book needs to address these things. You say it very well.
Oh, I've been trying a very long time to get my book out.
Well, I know, me
too. It's going to come out anytime.
Me too. But you're going to get it. So the way Esther Perel ends, she's quoted in Larry Gottlieb's article, at the end, it's a tall order for one person to be your partner in Management, Inc., your best friend and passionate lover. There's a certain part of you that with this partner will not be fulfilled. You deal with that loss. It's a paradox to be lived with, not solved. Yeah, she talks about some separateness being essential for real eroticism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that that's definitely true for a lot of people. And finding, again, that your own genuine experience that's authentic and meaningful for you is what I'm always guiding people towards. And maybe there are some couples that just need to be attached and attuned, and that's what works for them. And there's other couples who have a very independent relationship, and there is a lot of separation, and that works for them. I think the freedom to explore those different aspects of how to relate is what's most important, so that you know there's choices. A lot of couples don't feel like there's choices. They feel like they're in a rut, and whatever rut that's in, that's how it's been and how it'll always be, and they feel very discouraged that there's no all other way to relate. And when in fact, I think the appropriate use of, you know, sex therapy and sexual medicine is to help give just people ideas and choices to explore.
Absolutely. Serena, the Progressive Radio Network likes me to stop a little bit before the top of the hour, so we're going to end. But I'm so grateful for this hour with you, and you're so articulate and brilliant.
Oh,
and
well,
intuitive.
Right back at you, darling.
Yes, and I'm so glad that we did this show together. And kind of as a way to end, because it is a Valentine's Day show, so it's personal, but I think I'm sure you can relate to it, and many people. So when I say I love you to Brian, my man, the words are not spoken out of habit. It's my way of saying thank you for being you, and of returning some of the joy that you've given me. So I want to say to our listeners, if you have a Valentine, make the most of it and stay open, because maybe you'll fall in love and get a Valentine, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So go team love.
Oh, I love that. Thank you, Serena. And we'll do this again soon, I hope. Next week, I have urologist Dr. Dudley Danoff, and he is the author of Penis Power. Great title of book. Hmm?
Yeah.
So happy Valentine's Day to everybody. And again, Serena, thank you so much.
Thanks again for having me.
You're welcome. Bye-bye, everybody. Bye.
Cosa leggerai, con che libro affascini il tuo cuore, e se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amore.